Hey, very okay podcast fans. It's been a month, but we're back. First off, we're going to start off with a preview of our next episode on Bruce Goff. And we have Brittany Harris here, who is actually producing and directing a documentary on Bruce Goff. She's doing an Indiegogo fundraising campaign, and we want to help her out. Can you tell us a little bit about it, Brittany?
Yeah, Goff is a story about an architect in the Midwest who kind of grew up and created his own unique form of architecture here and kind of was underrecognized, and we're trying to bring his story back to life.
Where can they find information about the documentary, and how can they connect with you?
You can go to goffdocumentary.com. It has info about the fundraiser as well as the movie and what is going to happen in the future with it.
Throw a couple bucks and make this happen.
Yeah, and we'll be speaking with Brittany soon in 2 weeks from now during our next episode.
Yeah, now let's get to the Stork Club.
All right.
Tell me, Miss Peabody, what do you think of the Stork Club?
Oh, swell. That was a nice tour we had just now.
I operate this club along my own original ideas.
Yes, sir. Particularly when you say no check.
You see, the Stork Club is the mecca for celebrities from all over the world. They come here to eat, see, and be seen.
Hey, Corey.
Hey, Angela. What's going on?
Not much. It's been a while.
Yeah, we've been gone for a month from the podcast.
We have.
I mean, I see your mug every day.
Well, yeah.
Almost every
unfortunately,
day. Every work
we
day.
Do. So. Yeah. Yeah. So did you do anything fun over the break?
I watched about 65 to 70 episodes of Doc McStuffins with my daughter.
Oh, what's Doc McStuffins?
She is a little girl who is a doctor to her stuffed animals.
Okay. So she just fixes or repairs her?
Yeah. There's all sorts of... You would be amazed at how many problems stuffed animals and little toys can have, and she fixes them. They come alive for her. She's got a magic stethoscope.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds pretty exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if I, like, I'm trying to think. Surely I binged watched something, but can't really think.
Yeah, I don't suggest Doc McStuffins.
Don't do that.
Theme song is seared into my head. So.
Did you get anything fun? Did you get any good presents or... good food or something? Family time?
Well, family time. That was a lot of the family time.
Yeah.
We played a lot. I didn't really get much, but my daughter got a bunch of stuff.
Of course.
So I'm like reliving Christmas memories through her.
Yeah, I saw the fabulous train set.
Yes.
That you had set up under the tree. That was pretty awesome.
Which took me like an hour and two glasses of bourbon to put together.
I can only imagine.
So how about you? Did you get out?
I did get out a little bit, mostly just spent time with the family, caught up on some other work stuff, work projects, and then I went out a couple of times.
Did you see our picture in 405 magazine?
I did, yeah. So thanks to 405.
Yeah, they had an article about the podcast.
Yeah, you should pick up this month's issue.
Yeah, my friend actually cut me out of it, laminated me, and made me into a bookmark.
That's creepy.
Yeah, it was funny.
Who is this?
Carly, my friend Rod.
Okay.
His girlfriend.
Okay. Okay.
So thanks, Carly, for that weird bookmark.
I'll tell you, I do
rather
not.
Rather unsettling.
I don't want a bookmark of my pictures. My action shots. Oh, you know, you're never happy with what you look like in a picture, though.
Yeah, yeah. Unless you're me, I'm a good looking man.
Oh, yeah, and so photogenic.
Where'd you go when you were out and about? See, I don't go out and about once a quarter.
Yeah. Well, now that you're a parent, because used to go out some. My usual haunt is the Hilo here in Oklahoma City.
Been there, done my time. Done my time.
Done your time. Yep. And
so, did you see anybody famous there?
Well, like who?
J. Edgar Hoover?
No.
John F. Kennedy?
No.
Ernest Hemingway?
You do realize that all of these people are dead, right?
I do. I do. But Orson Welles, dead as well.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
Well, the reason I bring up all these people is because all these people were frequent patrons of one of the most famous nightclubs in the world, the Stork Club. And you're probably wondering, well, let's talk about what the Stork Club was. Started off as a speakeasy in New York City.
Mm-hmm. 1929?
1929?
Mm-hmm. And quickly, like, became the place for celebrities and A-listers to hang out, to, you know, to see and be seen.
Arthur Winchell, a famous newspaper columnist in New York, called the Stork Club the New Yorkiest place in New York.
You've been to New York. You were there just a few months ago,
actually. Yeah, it's crazy.
It seems like if you've been to New York City, then you kind of understand what they're talking about, the most, you know, the New Yorkiest. It was just the epitome of glamour and glitz. And I can't even think. I was trying to think when we were looking at this stuff and researching, I was trying to think of an equivalent nowadays.
I was thinking, like, with how famous it became, there's not...
I mean, it was in movies and books.
Like 80s level Hard Rock Cafe, but there's only... But there's only one.
Right. If there were only one Hard Rock Cafe
in
New York City or LA or something.
And it was a glamorous.
Did famous people go to Hard Rock Cafe unless they were like presenting them with their guitar or their dress or something?
I'm sure like the first one. Right?
I don't know. I mean, because there have been several, you know, different like Coco Cabana. You could even say, like, what, the Viper Room or CBGB's.
Whiskey A Go-Go.
Studio 54. There are all kinds of, like, really famous nightclubs. Maybe it's just because I'm old and I live in Oklahoma City that I don't know any glamorous places, but I don't read about it in, the tabloids or...
No other nightclub hotspot really had, A, the longevity that the Stork Club had, and B... a TV show that made it a household name.
Right. And I guess it's kind of a sign of that time. It's a product of that period with the glamorous movie stars and the music and the whole shtick that goes with that.
Well, so by now you're probably wondering, why in the heck are we talking about this place called the Stork Club
in New York City?
We're talking about the Stork Club because the owner...
Mm-hmm. Sherman Billingsley.
Was from Oklahoma.
Enid, to be exact.
And this isn't one of the things where he, like, was born on a wagon and then left. I mean,
right.
He
it's
was
not
raised...
like how Brad Pitt lived here for a minute or something.
Yeah, Sherman Billingsley was a true Oklahoman. I mean, his family came to Enid in 1893. It was part of the land opening in 1893. And he was born in Enid in 1896.
Right. So youngest of seven siblings.
Yeah. One brother passed away at an early age. And he had his sister, but there were like four main Billingsley brothers that would get up to all sorts of hijinks.
Right. They're kind of trouble. So eventually they moved to Anadarko, right?
Yeah,
when Sherman's really young.
1901. And that's the first time that he got his taste in illicit bootlegging.
Right. Because older brother Logan, he's actually started running beer to the local Native Americans around there, which was totally illegal.
Yeah. Illegal at the time to be selling alcohol in Indian
territory. So that's kind of where they started getting into bootlegging.
Yeah, they would load up. Logan would load up Sherman's little red wagon full of beer, cover it with a blanket.
Because he was like 4 or 5 and they're doing this.
Yeah, it's like, have you seen The Wire?
Oh, yeah.
Using young hoppers.
So Sherman was a little hopper.
Yeah.
Okay. So they're in Anadarko, but Logan... gets a girl knocked up.
He does, yeah. He gets a girl pregnant, denies that it's him, enrages the father, and there's an altercation, and Logan shoots and kills him.
Wow. What pans out of that?
He ends up marrying the woman. Mm-hmm. The father dies. He goes to court. It's this big, long, drawn-out court. He basically gets off, but the family's distraught, and they decide to get out of Anadarko, and they move to Oklahoma City.
The family moves to Oklahoma City, 1912?
Yeah, 1912. And it doesn't take Logan too long to find trouble again, and he immediately gets into the bootlegging business, and he opens up a pharmacy. See, even though Oklahoma is a dry state at the time, you can still get up to a gallon a month prescribed to you.
Okay, it's like medical.
A pharmacy.
It's like my medicine.
My medicinal whiskey. And so what he would do is go buy up allotments from people that didn't use it, and then sell them in the pharmacy.
Oh, so that's pretty smart. But then also, not just going past like the prescribed allowance, if you can store it in medicinal bottles, and yeah, then people just think they're exactly. buying, you're just buying medicine. Nobody even knows.
And he'd have caches off-site. So his first one was the Night and Day drugstore on West Grand.
In Oklahoma City.
Yeah. And it was kind of in this area where the Skirvin, the Lee Hutchins, and the Kincaid hotels were. And that was kind of the hub of all the action and all the vice as well. So there were gambling dens. Yeah. The pharmacy and brothels were down
right,
in this area.
Right, so there's a lot of people there coming.
A lot of people, a lot of action.
And goings.
A lot of vice.
And Skirvin Hotel is still, actually, it was reopened a few years ago. So that's still in downtown Oklahoma City.
And then Logan ends up getting Sherman into the game. So Logan's pharmacy business is doing pretty well. So Sherman goes in with them and they buy another pharmacy called the Lyric by the Skirvin Hotel. Soon they're realizing they need more booze. They can't just go out and buy people's allotment.
Right.
So this is when they begin actually running booze from out of state.
Rum running, yeah.
Yeah, buying cars. You know, they fixed it all up so you couldn't see there were boxes in the back and got special shocks so you couldn't see it was weighted down and all the
stuff that you kind of saw. What was the show?
Boardwalk Empire.
Boardwalk Empire. When you'd watch them like running all booze, all the little secrets and tricks that they would do.
And that's because Prohibition is coming. It's not here yet, but Oklahoma's dry, and the temperance movement is in the culture, and states are going dry, which you'll see that the Billingsley brothers kind of follow this pattern of following states as they go dry and then filling the demand.
Filling the need. So, of course, it doesn't take long for Logan to get in trouble yet again.
Yeah, Logan, the oldest Billingsley, strikes a gentleman with a pool stick, almost kills him, and so they skedaddle.
So how do you almost kill someone with a pool stick? I'm just thinking, what do you think it would be, the eye?
I don't know. It's got to be gruesome.
Yeah, or you're really, really strong.
You'd kill me, just it wouldn't take much.
It's true. You don't. You're a little breakable. You're a little fragile.
Slight.
Delicate.
I like to consider myself slight. So after they have to skedaddle and get out of Oklahoma, they kind of bounce around all over the place. They go to Charlton, West Virginia. Then they go to Seattle, where Logan is involved in a big brouhaha and a shootout. Actually, Sherman Billingsley wasn't there at the time. He was back in Oklahoma getting married. Then they go to Nebraska, and they end up in Detroit. And what they're doing is they go in and they set up these pharmacy operations.
Just all over the country.
Just like in Oklahoma. They kind of follow the pattern of the temperance movement as they make states dry. In Detroit is actually where Sherman's luck runs out. Logan's kind of ran out in Seattle, but in Detroit, Sherman runs out, gets busted in a sting operation and running booze, and serves 15 months in Leavenworth.
When
he was 18.
That would be scary.
That would be scary.
So eventually, Logan gets out of prison. Does he escape prison, or is he just...
He does. He escapes prison, and he ends up in New York getting into real estate.
Who knew? You know, times are so different back then when you can do this. Isn't it amazing, like, how now you couldn't get away with any of this because we're so tracked?
And all these brothers that seem like they're just trouble all around.
Right, right.
They all end up wildly successful and famous.
Yeah, only in America.
Yeah.
So Sherman goes to visit Logan in New York City.
Sherman goes, this is the
just
first
for
time.
A visit.
Just for a visit. He was only going to stay a couple hours to warn him about his conviction in Seattle. Yeah, he just went to warn and he ended up staying 40 years.
Well, you know, it's New York City.
It is mesmerizing. So this is where Sherman immediately sees opportunity. When he arrives in New York City, we're 4 months into Prohibition.
Okay, so this is the very beginning of Prohibition. It's gone national, not just from state to state. And
The Volstead Act has been signed. And
if you couldn't keep Oklahoma dry, can you imagine you're not going to be able to keep New York City dry?
Prescription booze is still a thing.
Yeah.
And it wasn't illegal to consume alcohol. The government could produce, nobody could produce it or sell it, but the government.
Gotcha.
So if you read up on Prohibition, it's
so convoluted.
It's convoluted and it's just rife for corruption.
Right.
And it was not vigorously enforced by just in pockets.
Right. Right. There's only certain groups that were really driving force behind it.
A lot of state police and local officials would be like, well, this is a federal law. This should be up to federal. And of course, there's not enough federal agents in the world to be
to
able
make
to
sure that people aren't, yeah, aren't
and
doing
there's
this.
A, you know, I like booze. I don't know about you.
Yeah, no, you know, I do too. I like to have a nice drink every once in a while. I can't imagine. It's weird to me that was even a thing, actually, because it's just, it's ingrained in our culture to just go and have a drink. Can't believe it, like, being prohibited.
Well, drunkenness was quite the problem.
Yeah, well, I can see that, too. That's still kind of a problem. I've seen that problem, too, so.
Well, if you, we won't go on a tangent about Prohibition, but Ken Burns' documentary Prohibition.
Right, it's really interesting.
Yeah, if you're looking to take a nap on a Sunday. Okay, let's take a break for a minute and collect ourselves, and we'll see you in a second. Okay, so Sherman is in New York. His pharmacies are going well. He's making pretty good money. And then he decides to open up a speakeasy in 1929, 132nd West 58th Street, just down the street from his apartment, and the Stork Club is born.
Right, and as far as his like writings and recollections, he doesn't really even know why it was named the Stork Club.
I know, which is really disappointing.
I know, I think that's weird too. I read somewhere that that there was actually a club already named the Stork Club that he had kind of purchased the rights to, because they're speakeasies. This is Prohibition. So I guess he was approached by two gamblers from that he knew from Oklahoma City who wanted to open up a restaurant.
Okay.
Then that's how the Stork Club was, okay, was born.
In case you don't know, a speakeasy is a place where you go to get booze during Prohibition.
Right.
They were, could be dinner clubs or restaurants, but you'd go there and they'd serve booze. And normally they had a lookout, and if they were raided, they could, you know, they'd have hidden compartments. They could throw all the contraband
all the
in.
Yeah, like in the movies. I also read that speakeasy, that the name came from people speaking softly or speak easy so that they wouldn't bring attention to the establishment.
Loose lips,
sink ships,
and get our booze taken away.
That's true. So people are still drinking.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. What Will Rogers said, that prohibition is better than no booze. Or something along those lines.
Well, and this is also a great time when they're coming up with all kinds of different cocktails, because a lot of the, I guess a lot of the alcohol wasn't that great. So they're mixing this kind of gross,
if you got
strong alcohol.
Your bathtub gin, you need to spruce it up with a little something.
So they're coming up with all these fancy new cocktails and that are kind of coming back now.
So the Stork Club at first is kind of a flop.
Right, right. And then one of his friends, Tex...
Yeah,
Guinan.
Tex Guinan, who was a vaudeville star, and she owned a bunch of speakeasies around. And she was like a rodeo star, vaudeville star.
Also on Star Trek.
Yeah. No. Actually, her name, Tex Guinan from Star Trek, is named after this woman.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
My little Star Trek inner fan was very excited to
find that out.
Yeah, when I'm researching the Stork Club, I'm not...
You're not looking for
going to be a Star Trek Next Generation reference.
Right, especially a Whoopi Goldberg.
Oh, man. Sister Act 2.
Yeah, I know. I was a fan.
Jumpin' Jack Flash. Do you remember that?
Oh, absolutely. I loved all of the Whoopi Goldberg movies. Okay. So I was a huge fan. Fatal Beauty. I'm telling you. I can pull them out of the woodwork. She was like my favorite when I was a kid. So Tex, anyways, introduces Sherman to Walter Winchell.
Yeah, who was a super influential columnist for the New York Daily Mirror. Mm-hmm. And this, you have to understand that we think of newspapermen back and then, this kind of austere, proud tradition. This was like, he was like the TMZ of his day.
Right. Some say that they even, Sherman, Billingsley, and Winchell actually started what we know as like celebrity culture. Or like, you know, like
the gossip route.
Yeah, it was the gossip. And so he was bringing people in by the time that, this is 1930-ish.
So Tex Guinan introduces Walter Winchell to Sherman, Billingsley, and the Stork Club.
Mm-hmm.
And... all it takes is...
a write-up in his gossip column.
Yeah.
And all of the elite, the New York City wealthy elites are there like that evening. This is September of 1930.
And like we said earlier, he calls it the New Yorkiest place in New York.
Right, right.
And then he became a staple at the...
Walter
Winchell, yeah.
Own table, table 50. So, and I guess that was like kind of the base, becomes the base of his column and his... even his radio show later on, is just seeing and gossiping about all of the celebrities that are coming to the Stork Club.
And so celebrities would go to see each other, and then normal people would go to see celebrities.
Right, so they're just kind of all fed off of each other.
At this point, he's a hit, and the Stork Club is starting to fill up.
Right, right. They even, Prohibition agents had even closed them down by the end of 1931. And so they just kind of moved it on down the street.
This is when they, normally they would just raid the place, shut you down for a few days, you'd pay a fine.
Yeah.
But this time agents came in and they took everything. A new ruling, a new reading by a judge said that if you were selling, like, had a speakeasy, everything in it was federal property. Oh. And so what they started doing is, instead of just shutting them down, cleaning the place out, like...
And taking everything.
Yeah, and this is a restaurant, too, so they're taking, like... Yeah. Yeah, you can't run a restaurant without all your light fixtures, stoves, refrigerators, so they just clean the place out. So they just moved it.
So you had to just kind of start all over again from scratch, and they moved it, what, to East 51st Street. I used to live on 51st Street in Oklahoma City, so I remember that.
So from 31 to 34, the Stork Club is at the East 51st Street location.
Okay, right. And then after repeal, Billingsley moves the Stork Club to its final location where it will see the rest of its days.
Which is East 53rd.
Right, right. And it's, you know, Prohibition's gone, so woohoo.
Yeah, and it was not much of a, you know, it was a pretty easy transition
to move.
It's just move everything out in the open.
Right. But during this time, he had like a huge opening because it's legal. So he could do it all out in the open. And he sent out 1,000 invitations to, you know, the swankiest people and the best of the best for a champagne dinner.
Ooh,
so,
fancy.
Yeah, yeah.
And even before this idea of lavishing special VIPs with gifts, this was already part of his whole rigmarole.
Right, right. He had kind of...
If you were a high roller or somebody famous, you were often didn't pay a tab.
Right.
Got dinner for free.
Yeah, he took care of his big-time stars and big-time regulars to come in. So all this time, Sherman, or Mr. Billingsley, he's building up his clientele. And it's really the place to, like you said, be seen. And it's where kind of the cafe society is hanging out now.
And not only that, after 33 and then into the World War II years, the Depression is ending. And people have even more cash.
Right, right. But, I mean, the Stork Club did really well, considering, especially during World War II, when other people were having to ration. Sherman had so many different connections, even some mob connections, that were allowing for his restaurant to stay open where they weren't having to ration the food like a lot of the other places. So, you know, you could still go in and get your meat or your cheeses or whatever was being rationed for the rest of the country.
And he'd offer GIs free drinks and things. And what he wanted was those write-ups and pictures in the press of a GI getting off on leave and coming straight to the Stork Club.
Yeah, yeah, taking a girl to the Stork Club.
If you're big in any of the restaurant industry at this time or nightclubs, the mafia is out there
pretty
in New
much.
York.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's just kind of a fact back then. And one of the Stork Club regulars is Frank Costella, who was running the mob while Lucky Luciano was in jail. And Billingsley, you know, he would kind of dabble with the mob a little bit, but they had to be like the fancy pants one. He wasn't running around with like hoodlums or, you know, street gangsters or something.
He actually got pressured into kind of teaming up with three members of the mob and was kidnapped for evening. So.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't have a choice. That's the thing. When they come around, you know, they can pressure you. And
yeah, it's the mob.
I'm assuming. This is how it works.
How it worked with you?
I've never been
when you were kidnapped. So there's all kinds of characters, actually, that are hanging out there. J. Edgar Hoover's, he's coming in with his FBI men. And
it's hilarious. How many times he was on like a first name basis, he would call up J. Edgar Hoover and ask for investigations all the time.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, like in the book, like 7 different investigations that he ran for him.
Wow. Yeah. That's pretty well, I guess that kind of just goes along with J. Edgar Hoover's personality. So why is the Stork Club so popular? I mean, it's exploded. Everybody knows what the Stork Club is. It's national.
Even my parents, I asked the other day, I was like, hey, have you ever heard of the Stork Club? Dad knew exactly what it was. I mean, it was so popular, it was a household. It was the epitome of swank, glamorous lifestyle for
fancy
up until the 60s.
Right. Some would say that Sherman, he had like this 4-step strategy, and this is what made it so popular. And people even today who are running different clubs are still using these 4 steps. So the first thing is to make it difficult to get in. So you want it to be kind of exclusive.
He had a gold chain.
Yeah. You know, I mean, like he actually made it difficult to get in.
Yeah, there's like a physical barrier.
Right.
A man,
a bouncer.
Yeah, there's a man with a gold chain that will let you in or, you know.
Or not.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine being rejected?
Yes, so, Angela. I
So the second thing is to pamper the big names, mainly by, well, not only showering them with gifts, but not making them have to, they don't have to pay for any of their stuff, their tabs, or they're getting champagne sent over there. And then also to create like a private space within the club.
Ooh, the cub room.
Yeah, yeah. And that was the name of the inner room of the Stork Club, was the Cub Room, C-U-B. That's where all of the big names could kind of get together, but they wouldn't be annoyed by their fans.
Do you think it's like cubby, or do you think they actually raised small bears?
I'm pretty sure that they raised small bears.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So the last thing he did was he allowed a house photographer to record all these, like, take pictures of all of these famous people.
It's kind of like controlling your narrative, right?
Yeah, it's genius. And then they rush these photos to the tabloids. So you've got, you know, Walter Winchell there already writing up the gossip columns. He's just a fixture. Then you have the photographers for all of these. I mean, it's really smart. And you think, you know, this is before televisions and, you know, people, you know, this. So you're reading this stuff in all of the tabloid magazines and in the newspapers. So like you said, it's kind of like the TMZ of the time.
Yeah. It's like how we only let like photos of us and Jay-Z.
You know, we only leak those ever so often.
Exactly.
So, but, and it's just, you know, all the big names.
The Stork Club was not just, there were several parts to it.
Yeah.
There was kind of the main entrance area. Mm-hmm. There was a little bar area. There was mm-hmm. the dining room. There was a caterer. It was like three floors at its height. It was three floors. It was not just
a big open room. Right.
Think like, if juniors had a whole other level or something.
That would be.
Because there's the little bar area in mm-hmm. juniors, then there's then the main dining area. Yeah.
And even the little entrance hall.
Yeah. I think juniors is the closest we're going to get to the Stork Club in Oklahoma City.
Now, yeah. Now, there used to be Dooley's. You remember Dooley's?
Oh, do I remember Dooley's? Yeah. That's my wheelhouse. People would describe it as a dive bar, and I would get incensed because it was so nice. It reeked of old oil money.
Oh, but
it
yeah. was
underneath
slinky.
The Klassen Tower if you mm-hmm. on 18th.
The mirrors.
It was so fancy and
I
nice.
I would live in
And there were
Dooley's.
Great old couples that would dance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And juniors is still kind of like that, actually. Yeah, yeah. You know, they have the piano in there, the piano man that comes in.
And I bet when these older folks saw us coming in, they were just like, oh, there goes the neighborhood.
Probably.
These young hipsters.
Probably.
Yeah. But Dooley's was... Man, yeah, that was a good bar.
It was good. Good stuff.
Dirty vodka martini at Dooley's. I'm going to take you out to the Stork Club.
Take me to the Stork Club.
Well, you got to dress up.
Okay.
What are you going to wear? What do you have to wear? What are you required to wear?
I'm wearing a probably kind of like an evening gown. And I think I'm required to wear gloves that even go past my elbows.
Which you have on now, which is good.
Well, I always
you can just wear those.
Yeah. I might switch them out for my silk one. I mean, I usually just wear my leather every day.
You're every day.
Full leather. But so I'd be, you know, and you would be in your evening wear. You'd have to have a tie, period. If you didn't have a tie, then they would
I'd have to
find
buy
you
one at the door. Yeah. Hopefully, Sherman, I'd be like, hey, Sherm. And he'd,
Shermy.
I doubt that would work.
Shermy, baby.
And he would do that all the time. Neckties were a big deal with him. He had like crazy collection of over like 2,000 neckties and big thing with in Stork Club neckties giving them out
was
a huge deal.
I believe he actually sent a small collection of neckties, brand new neckties to Franklin Roosevelt.
Nice.
At one point, yeah. And once we walked in, then in our evening dress, women they'd receive like an orchid or a gardenia as a corsage.
I mean, this is a formal affair. When I say swank, I mean, going to the Stork Club was a night out.
Yeah, yeah. I'd love to just go back in time and go there once. That'd be awesome. So all these people are dressed up. He has certain standards. One thing that, you know, a lot of people didn't want to talk about because it wasn't explicitly stated, but African-Americans really weren't...
Yeah, African-American, unless you were at the top of your class,
right?
It was kind of an unspoken rule. It was segregated, like a lot of society at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though New York City was... You know,
one of the
very
least.
Liberal and metropolitan. Yeah. There was still segregation going on.
Yeah, which is kind of sad because during the speakeasy time period, I know that there was a lot of desegregation in the speakeasies, and so it's kind of sad that it kind of went.
Yeah, and there was also a lot of women and men getting together in situations that were illegal.
Right.
So a lot of the social morals that would go along with, you know, drinking socially were gone. So you'd have women alone at the bar.
And smoking cigarettes or something like that, where they weren't supposed to actually be smoking out in public.
One thing is important to know about the Stork Club is Sherman was an ever-present presence. Is that?
Ever-present presence. Yeah. I'll go with it.
Okay. I mean, he was the man who ran the show.
Right.
He could give you two little secret hand motions to his staff. He could get everybody free champagne.
Right.
I mean, he had a whole...
Or kicked out.
Or kicked out, yeah. He had a whole hand signal thing, mm-hmm. and he was well-known at the club and around New York City right. and eventually all of America.
Yeah, I mean, he's just as famous as his, this, you know...
Yeah, I mean, it was the Stork Club...
Bootlegger boy from...
The Stork Club and Sherman Billingsley were...
One and the same.
One and the same, yeah.
So he's pretty strict on conduct, too. So not only did you have to, like, look a certain way or, you know, you also had to act a certain
yeah,
way.
Yeah, I thought this was totally crazy because I picture all these A-list celebrities just drunk and kind of wild. But yeah. One thing, he really hated table hoppers.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was at Milton Berle that got kicked
yeah,
out.
Yeah, he got banned for a while. You know... Tons of celebrities got kicked out and mm-hmm. briefly banned, some banned for life. Ernest Hemingway was banned mm-hmm. for a little while.
Humphrey Bogart, I believe, was banned. Yeah. So these are really big names. Can you imagine anywhere else in the world where they would ban Humphrey Bogart back at this time?
No.
No. So, but he had strict rules that he wanted the place to be safe and be welcoming and to not annoy, I think, just to not be annoying.
Yeah, and if you had a bunch of table hoppers and people, it would be kind of chaos. And if you were there right. to enjoy the people that you brought and enjoy your evening, then you didn't want a bunch of people at your table.
No.
A bunch of loud raucousness.
Yeah, yeah. He did have an associate, though, Steve Hannigan, I believe was his name, that kind of, he thought, well, you know, one good fight every year or so would be permitted just to kind of, you know, get it. Rough up the edges a little bit, get in the tabloids for something like that.
Sherman Billingsley was notoriously hard on his staff.
Oh, yeah. It was not fun to work with them.
Yeah, you made a ton of money. I think I haven't made a ton of money, but he was just ridiculously hard on his staff. And he wasn't completely unreasonable, but it was he butted up against the edge of being unreasonable.
Right. You know, what's funny is that's like the true story, but have you ever, there's a little movie called The Stork Club.
Yeah, the sample that you first heard at the beginning of the podcast.
And if you can actually watch the whole thing.
It's on Amazon Prime.
It is.
If it's unwatchable.
Well, it's, you know, it's just kind of a
yeah.
goofy screwball comedy from the 40s, but
it's a Three's Company. There's lots of misunderstandings.
Yeah. So, I mean, he seems very lovely and understandable in that. Of course, everybody's a little bit scared of him, but it's actually about the Stork Club.
We talked about Sherman showering, you know, patrons with tons mm-hmm. of gifts, and not only gifts, but there were just tons of keepsakes.
Right,
that
with
were,
the name.
With the name Stork Club and mm-hmm. name and the logo. It was, what are some of the items here?
Oh, well, Stork Club lipstick, like tubes of lipstick. They had their own perfume. They had, ashtrays.
Ashtrays. I think they went through, I think I read something like 200 ashtrays would come up missing a week.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Because that was the deal, to go to the Stork Club.
Yeah.
It became a thing. We've actually got a Stork Club ashtray or two in our collection.
Yeah, we do. And they have the little stork on them. Yeah, he was spending an average of $100,000. Think about that, on gifts a year.
That's a lot of money. But when you're bringing
now.
In 1.5
yeah,
at the time.
Yeah,
yeah. This is in 1940s
yeah.
money, you know?
Yeah. So that is, you know, but it's paying off for him because the big names are coming back or people are feeling special when they get to come in and they get their gifts. So this is probably also another reason why it became such... like so established in popular culture of the time. You know, you've got all these movie stars, you have all the fancy gifts, the champagne dinners, just all these giveaways.
They had balloon night on
yeah,
Sunday nights?
Yeah, balloon night, where what is, you pop a balloon and there would be maybe $100 bill in it?
Yeah. See, yeah. That seems kind of low class to me, but I guess back then maybe there was some fun to it.
Maybe balloons were, I don't know.
Seems to me like one of those boxes where they put money and you have to grab as much as you can.
Oh, those things that blow?
Yeah. But I guess back then it was charming.
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of, you know, probably a lot of nightclubs back then probably had, like, the balloons fall from this. Have you, you know, when you watch a lot of old movies and at the end of the dance or whatever, like, the balloons fall from the ceiling. So I think it was kind of a thing. So there's actually even, there becomes the television show.
Yes, ill-conceived television show, mm-hmm. which ran from 1950 to 55. It was on CBS.
Mm-hmm. And weird, Yul Brynner was the director. That's before he became famous.
Yeah, and then he left mid-show because he was like, oh, I just got this gig on a show called The King and I.
We'll see how that goes. But they had actually built a replica of the Cub Room on the sixth floor of the Stork Club building.
From all accounts that I've read, this Stork Club show was painful to watch.
That's what I heard,
and
too.
Sherman was the host, and he insisted on being the host.
And I think he wasn't very good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this also, at a time when television was still kind of in its infancy, brought the Stork Club into
everybody's living room, the nation's
home. So right. Glitz, glamour, New York cafe society, bam, there it is across the entire nation.
Especially if you have a favorite movie star, you're going to watch it no matter what. You know, back in the day, I would have watched anything. If David Bowie was on something, then I would tune in to anything with David Bowie on it. So I'm getting, you know, the fans of these movie stars are going to do that.
Labyrinth.
Actually, I watched Labyrinth the other day. It was on TV.
Good. Still hold up?
I cannot say that objectively.
Because of Jennifer Connelly?
No, because I love that movie so much. It means so
much
to me.
Or because of David Bowie's codpiece.
Codpiece, definitely. So there's several movies, too, where it's not, well, like I said, The Stork Club, that's an actual movie, where they paid Billingsley to even use that, $100,000 just to use the name, The Stork Club, in the movie. And this is just a cheesy little 40s rom-com kind
of thing. He was in an Alfred Hitchcock movie, The Stork Club was in it.
And that one, the Alfred Hitchcock was actually based on a true story.
Yeah, The Wrong Man, I think it was called.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I've seen that one, so we're gonna have to look that one up. With Henry Fonda. I love Henry Fonda, so I'm kind of surprised that I haven't seen it, or maybe I just don't remember it. But he plays a bassist from the Stork Club, and I guess it's a true story. Who was accused of murder, but didn't actually commit the murder.
Looked ridiculously like the true murderer.
Right, right. So that one might be worth checking out. Might be a little better than the Stork Club. Oh, and All About Eve. That's a pretty famous movie, and they actually show a lot of the actresses in the Stork Club. So, I mean, it's something special. And honestly, I mean, I can't think of anything that's been like that since, really.
I can't. You know, we mentioned earlier, like, Hard Rock Cafe or Studio. Maybe Studio 54 is the only other thing.
Right. But it wasn't, you know, quite like, I mean, that was just a little bit more, you know,
more
crazy
disco
party.
And cocaine.
Yeah. Not so much. Yeah.
Class and booze.
Right. Not so much Elizabeth. Well, probably Elizabeth Taylor by then. So everything is going just, you know, fabulous. And then we start kind of running into some controversies.
Yeah, there's a few things that kind of are little hiccups in the success of the Stork Club. Mm-hmm. One is that Sherman Billingsley can't really adapt to unions. He was vehemently anti-union early on because the mob controlled the union.
Right.
And he was super paranoid about his waiters and waitresses and staff unionizing.
Uh-huh. This is like an irrational. This isn't just like a normal.
No. He would like clean out entire. I think he had a full staff of 200. He'd go in and fire 100 people in one.
Right,
one swoop.
In just one swoop. And I mean, he started. You know, he was getting paranoid. I read that he was starting to put electronic bugs in the kitchen.
Oh, the whole place was wired up.
Yeah. And just, I mean, that's getting pretty paranoid. And not only that, but he still was really hanging on to, like, on the whole integration thing with them keeping it segregated.
Yeah, there was a big stink when Josephine Baker, the singer-dancer, African-American, was snubbed. And there's, you know, back-and-forth accounts of if she was really snubbed in her party that she was with, but she felt slighted. And let the press know about it.
Right. And this is 1951. So,
yeah.
It got out there and people, I mean, just not too cool. Even though I know segregation was still pretty heavy around the United States, but here in New York City, it was a little bit more integrated. Plus, it's Josephine Baker.
Yeah.
I mean, she's, you know, internationally known.
But it kind of played out because Arthur Wenchel, Billingsley's friend was big civil rights proponent. And so it kind of, he took Billingsley's side, and it went back and forth in the press where they both tried to smear each other. African Americans weren't overly welcome at the Stork Club. So
right.
That's kind of the gist.
Right. So they're not really moving with the times when the rest of the world is starting, at least in New York City, starting to kind of catch up, but the, you know, Stork Club is not. By 1956, the Stork Club is actually losing money.
Yeah, and another hiccup was the TV show. We mentioned it.
Yeah,
it was kind of a flop. Yeah, it wasn't good. It was kind of a flop, and it kind of became bit of an embarrassment.
Right.
By 56, Stork Club is
losing money.
That's the first year he didn't make a profit.
He's getting really paranoid. And by 1965,
we also have to say, like, he's a multimillionaire at this point.
Right.
I mean, so he's built this empire up on his own, and he's becoming older and kind of losing it. You know, when people, when they get that much money and power and you've got mob interest, I mean, he's got some rights to be paranoid, but he's starting to not handle it very well.
Right. Yeah, his paranoia is getting the better of him. And so the club starts hemorrhaging money, and people just aren't coming in. Like you said, you know, it's a different time. TV, the stars are different now. It's going to be different.
You've got a younger crop of people coming in, and they're going to have different, maybe they're slightly more bohemian, you know, they want.
Right. And also now it's not just New York City. You've got Las Vegas. You have Miami. You have different places where people are actually flocking to for this kind of entertainment. It's not just New York City. And Stork Club, I mean, frankly, is just getting kind of old hat.
Yeah. For a brand to endure that long and still stay fresh and cool, especially as a destination.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost impossible, really. Yeah. I mean, they really did a good run, but yeah, it's just going to be impossible, especially if he is still trying to, you know, control absolutely everything and getting paranoid.
Exactly.
So, you know, by the 60s, he is, you know, he can't keep the club going. He even emptied his daughter's trust fund of almost $10 million. And still,
couldn't
it's gone.
It
no, yeah.
And so what year did it close?
October 4th, 1965. And it's gone. It's closed forever. And everything is gone.
The idea is he was going to close it down, regroup, and have a big grand opening in a year. But he doesn't make it.
Yeah. He has a heart attack.
And his last words will go down as probably the most depressing last words. This is something I would say right before I keel over. Tell us, his wife at the time is Hazel.
Yeah, so, I thought it was kind of sweet. So his last words...
Is it sweet or paranoid? Because I read it as paranoid.
I don't know. I think it's cute.
Okay, but lay it on him.
So his last words are, Hazel, are you still hiding jelly beans under the mattress?
And then he dies of a heart attack.
And then he dies of it.
See, to me, that's accusatory.
To me, it's like that's her cute little quirk. She hides jelly beans like under the mattress. Like maybe that's her little nighttime snack. She hides them in the mattress.
I think he's accusing her of hiding jelly beans straight up. Where have you hidden the jelly beans, Hazel?
Well, that's the worst, that he's accusing her of hiding jelly beans.
We don't, jelly beans could be code.
That's true. So yeah, so exactly a year in their tiny East Side apartment. Their small East Side apartment, everything's gone. The club has picked all of his money.
Oh, he sold that. He had like a mansion there for a while.
Yeah.
Like a three-floor mansion.
He ended up dying in a small apartment East Side. Yeah. And his reputation's gone too. So.
Well, it lives on through us.
Yeah, I guess so.
No, and I'm sure we didn't even talk about this earlier, but. He was constantly suing people for opening up fake Stork Clubs. Its height, like he was.
Everybody was.
Yeah, everyone was opening up a Stork Club in different cities. And,
you know.
It'd be awesome to open up a Stork Club here, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I wonder if we can find some of his family that's still around.
I don't know. Somebody from one of the restaurant groups here. Give us a call. Angela and I can be, we can hold the gold chain.
We'll be the coat check girl. But, you know, it's a really interesting story that someone who with such humble roots of coming, you know, growing up in Oklahoma and coming from like a bootlegging kind of rum running tradition and becoming one of the most famous people in the world with one of the most famous nightclubs ever, probably in the history.
Yeah, that's, you know, when I mentioned I talked to my parents. I was like, you ever heard of the Stork Club? And they were like, oh, yeah. Did you know it was run and operated by an Oklahoman? They had no clue.
So, I mean, there's just so many interesting people here in Oklahoma. And I'm excited about our next podcast. We have another interesting person that a lot of people either don't know is from Oklahoma or they've never heard of him. But he's a very influential architect from mid-century architect Bruce Goff. And so this is kind of like my baby, I feel like, because you know how much I'm
you're gonna do the heavy driving next time.
Yeah. So. But it's just another
heavy lifting.
Heavy you're gonna driving. Do the heavy. I'd rather do the heavy driving.
Heavy lifting.
You'll do the heavy lifting. You know, I'm not very strong.
That's why somebody asked me what my greatest weakness was recently.
What'd you say?
An interview type situation, and I said
biceps,
my upper body. Yeah, if you're interested in reading more about the Stork Club, we both read The Stork Club by Ralph Blumenthal.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of our main source for our information about the Stork Club.
Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of information online, too. There's a pretty cool Stork Club website, and it has different memories and talks about different things. Also, memorabilia and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
And there, believe it or not, there are a lot of different interviews with people who worked at the Stork Club telling their firsthand accounts about like what their experience was there. So it's kind of fun to look into, especially if you're into like the, you know, old timey 40s glamour New York City stuff.
Yeah. See, I hate wearing ties, so I'd always be not dressed well enough.
Well, you can wear your gown and gloves.
Okay, good. Well, yeah, that's the Stork Club. We'll see you in 2 weeks. We're back on schedule. Sorry, folks.
Yeah. Sorry about that. But thanks for coming back and listening to us, as always.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. And if you can, get onto iTunes and write us a review. Or if you don't like the podcast, just email me personally.
Don't write us a review.
cairs@okhistory.org. So, and then you can complain there. But if you do like it, you know, it helps us.
It looks good for our bosses.
Looks good for our bosses. Keep us employed. We're state workers, and
we need all help.
We're having troubles. So. Okay, folks. See you in 2 weeks.